Today on the History Factory podcast, Louis Ferrante and a history of the American Mafia. I'm Jason Dressel, and welcome to the History Factory podcast, the podcast at the intersection of business and history. In today's pod, I'm going to talk to Lou Ferrante about the history of business through a different lens, the mafia in America. And look, if you're like me, you find mafia-themed content entertaining. And I'll admit it, I was both very interested to talk to Lou, and we calculated that a lot of listeners out there might be too. And this discussion and Lou's book, which I'll get to in a second, is both kind of what you'd expect if you know anything about the mafia. And it's also really different than a lot of other mafia books and documentaries and the kinds of things that we all are used to seeing. And to understand the context of the conversation, you need to know a little bit about Lou Ferrante. So Lou is actually a former mafia associate and heist expert who served 8 years in prison after refusing to incriminate his fellow Gambino family members. He was an associate of John Gotti in the 1990s. But here's the thing about Lou. It is more than fair to say that he is not your average person, and he certainly did not have the typical experience of a member of the mob during his time in prison or since. And what I mean by that is Lou is largely a self-taught, but nevertheless intellectual. While he was in prison, he took to books in a major way and genuinely gave himself an education in the classics and liberal arts. He studied religion, science, law, history, and after prison, he created a new life for himself as an author. He wrote a book called Mob Rules, which is an international bestseller translated into 20 languages. His Discovery Channel series, Inside the Gangster's Code, earned him a Grierson Award nomination for Presenter of the Year. And now he has written the first of a 3-volume series, Borgata, A History of the American Mafia. And it's an interesting read because it reads in many ways like what you might expect. And I think it's fair to say that mafia-themed content immediately conjures some assumptions. But it's also heavily influenced by the scholarly histories that Lou reads. And that's a big part of the reason why it's a different kind of history. The other consideration, of course, is that this is a world, a culture that Lou literally grew up in and understands innately. And to that point, one thing that Lou is really clear about is that most of the content that you read or watch about the mafia is inaccurate, distorted, and romanticized. So as you're about to hear, I intentionally didn't spend much time talking to Lou about his past and personal background, but I understand listeners may be curious about him. I intentionally really wanted to respect his work and focus the conversation on that. But if you're interested in learning more about Lou's personal experiences, there are other podcasts and media coverage that delve deeper into that. And it's well worth it. He's a fascinating guy. And there's a lot to unpack if you're interested in learning more about Louis Ferrante. He's on Wikipedia, and he has a website, louisferrante.com. But for our purposes, I really wanted to stay focused on the content of the book and the context that the mafia has been a presence in American business, in politics, in our culture for a long time. And how did the mafia come about and how has it evolved? Like Lou's book, we really avoided romanticizing what is a violent and illegal enterprise. So definitely a really interesting conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Here I am talking with Lou Ferrante. Lou Ferrante, welcome to the History Factory podcast. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Lou, first of all, congratulations on your book. Congratulations on the birthing volume one of the trilogy. It was a really fun read. And, one of the things I just wanted to start right out with is, I think one of the kind of themes of this category, and certainly one of the sort of themes of your work, is that you point out that, the history of the mafia is generally portrayed more like
historical fiction than really a serious field of study. And it's often romanticized. And I'm just curious first on kind of your take on why is that, and what are the general discrepancies between how the mafia is stereotypically portrayed and what's reality?
Yeah. So I'll start with the latter part of the question first, which is the stereotypes vary. You have The Godfather, which romanticizes the mob to the trillionth degree. I mean, that's like totally not real. Maybe at one time it was closer to reality, but in my own time, which would be the 1990s, late 80s, early 1990s, before I went to prison, those days were very much more like the movie Goodfellas, which is, you know, a little more reckless. The people were a little more violent, less given to a code. There was a code, but more people break it than not. So it was a different sort of time. So the movies do get it wrong in a sense. I thought that the Sopranos was done really well. When I was in prison, the guys used to go into the television room every week to watch the Sopranos, the mob guys I was with. And I would say, what are you watching that crap for? You know, that's what got us into this. You know, they'd tell me, come to the TV room. I'd rather keep my nose in a history book so I could move on after this. So I never went to watch it. And then at some point or another, I was in touch with Lorraine Bracco, who played Dr. Melfi on The Sopranos. Sure. And she actually purchased the movie rights to my first book, my memoir, Unlocked. And I said, oh shit, I never watched the show. I better get started watching these things. And I have to tell you, I got sucked in. I thought it was done really well. It was more gritty. It was more human. I thought they captured the family life very good. Tony Soprano's family life, the relationship between him and his wife and him and his kids. I can't tell you how many top mob guys' houses I've been in my life. So, I remember vividly conversations at the table between husbands and wives and children, et cetera. And I thought that they did a phenomenal job with that, the Sopranos did. And they also didn't hide anything. You know, Tony Soprano is a family man, but he's not, it's not beneath him to cut somebody's head off, you know, at 6 o'clock at night before he goes home to dinner and kisses his wife, you know, hello at the table. So this is sort of like, and he did, I think there was one scene where he did indeed cut somebody's head off in a bathtub. So they sort of got that stuff right. They didn't sort of glorify it. But the movies that do romanticize it are just phony. You know, the real thing is it's a lot of blood and guts. It's a lot of intrigues. Your life is always on the line. If you don't know how to operate in that world, you will find yourself in a jam. And if you get out with your life, you're lucky. So, you know, you need to know how to maneuver, how to navigate that world. It is a specific world. You have to learn it. And which I did, you know, my family wasn't mafia. My mother's side were knock around guys. I'm 100% Italian. My father's family was from Bari. My mother's mother was from Sicily and her father was from Naples. And her, you know, her side of the family, they were a little crooked, the Napoli Dons and Sicilians, but they weren't mob. So that was sort of new for me. And I was groomed by old timers who, and even young guys who grew up in the life, who taught me everything. I understood it. I was a quick learner and I took to it. And, you know, the reality is that you want to aspire to something like The Godfather, but you end up like something like Goodfellas. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that was really cool about the book is it really does sort of blend being a highly entertaining read, and you write it from first person in some places where you're able to kind of really hear your voice and your experiences. But it is a serious piece of history, and you obviously did your homework and really spent a significant amount of time. And we're going to talk about that. I want to hear more about just sort of the research process. But readers or listeners might be surprised to hear that the history begins in Sicily in the Middle Ages, and then it works up to the early origins of the mafia there in Sicily in the 1860s. Why did you make that choice? What's the kind of through line in terms of the events that shaped the unique characteristics of Sicilian culture that then kind of as you write sort of plant the seeds for the mafia?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why I began in Sicily. One was the book was hatched in Sicily. I was invited to speak for the German conglomerate Axel Springer, They were having a retreat for editors in Sicily, and I was seated next to, unbeknownst to me, when I arrived there, they had seating arrangements pre-planned, and they sat me next to an English-speaking person who was at the event. His name was George. And at the end of the night, he said, "I'd like to publish your next book." And it ended up being Lord George Weidenfeld, one of the biggest publishers of the 20th century. So here we are in Sicily. The next day we met overlooking the ruins of Agrigento. And he said, I said, "What kind of book would you like?" And he said, "I'd love for you to write the history of the American Mafia." And it began in Sicily. So that's sort of where I began, you know, where my mind, my train of thought began. I was in Sicily. And I should credit Lord George's lovely wife, Lady Annabel, with a lot of input. She was an avid reader when she was young, and she added tremendously to the conversation we had, convincing me that I was the person to write it. The next thing was, when I read a lot of mafia histories, when I started to do my research, everyone sort of, they skipped over the real origins. They'd say, "Well, it came from Sicily. Well, it was about family. Well, it was, you know, that was the way the Sicilians were. Well, it kind of maybe stemmed from feudalism," but nobody really ever went deep into it. So I said, "Well, where did it come from?" So I dug deep, and with the lead that, and they usually just jump into the blood and guts, which is what a lot of people just want to read about. And I have that all throughout Borgata. There's a lot of blood and guts. I go deep into the intrigues. I enjoy that stuff, the intrigues and the politics involved and how people were thinking. But I wanted to make sure that the reader understood where it all came from. And I went deep into feudal society. And I'm the first one ever to make those strong connections between feudal society, feudalism, and a modern day mafia family. There are literally exact things that they did during feudalism that they do now in a mafia family, whether it be oaths, whether it be the relationship between the lord and his vassals is identical to the relationship between a mafia don and his soldiers / capos. So all of that played a huge part. And I said, I want to draw the connection so the reader sees that this isn't just, I'm telling you it came from feudalism like everyone else. Let me show you. You know, that's really, I felt like always when I learned how to, when I taught myself how to write, I always read over and over again when I read the great authors, show me, don't tell me. So I wanted to show the reader how this came about. And the other thing where there was a lot of secret societies in Europe around the same time the mafia came about, in around the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, it starts picking up speed. And why is that? Well, the ancient regimes throughout Europe were being overthrown by a lot of secret society. Most of us are familiar with the Jacobins in France overthrowing, you know, causing the French Revolution. But there were a lot of other secret societies throughout Europe that wanted to get rid of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottomans, etc. So these secret societies, when they eventually achieved success by unifying Italy and ejecting the Austrians out of northern Italy and the French out of southern Italy / Sicily, the French Bourbons, they eventually then said, "Well, you know what? We don't need these secret societies anymore." And the mafia took a lot of what they left behind, and it was available at the time. And you could see, and why they needed it was the mafia in Sicily, the people who would become the mafia in Sicily, were originally just people who resisted this new Italian unification. They weren't happy with it. They were conned by Garibaldi and others. I don't know if Garibaldi knew he was conning them, but they were told that they would have independence once these overlords were thrown out of Italy and Italy was unified. And then they were told suddenly that they're part of this whole Italian experiment. And their new government is in originally Turin, but eventually Rome. And they're like, "What are you talking about? You know, we listen to ourselves. We don't want to listen to Rome. What the hell's Rome? What do the people in Rome know about us? In the foothills of Western Sicily, in Palermo, in Castellamare del Golfo, in Agrigento. What do they know about us? In Villabate, et cetera, et cetera." So they were very, very unhappy with it. And around that time, they started to sort of, the new government in Italy started to crush these resistance movements in Sicily. And that is when the mafia came about. They came about originally sort of as like protectors, I feel, for the people. And then they morphed into something very different. They were criminalized. They were told they were criminals by the larger government in Rome, originally, as I said, Turin. And they're told, "Well, you know, you guys are criminals. Everything you do is criminal. You can't have an old man in the piazza settling judicial disputes. This is ridiculous. We do that by court of law. You can't have him telling you who's going to be the mayor. We do that by ballot box, and the ballot box can't be tampered with. Yeah, these guys didn't want to hear that in Sicily. So, you know, they resisted this. And once they were labeled criminals, at some point, I think they didn't care how much more criminal conduct they engaged in because they were already labeled criminals. And that's, I make the argument very, very clearly in the book. I use quotes, I use references, I use geopolitics, social politics, et cetera, to really show the reader how it all came about. And there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of components to this. And I did my best to make it as clear as possible and as intelligible as possible. So by the time you finish those early chapters and the mafia just suddenly appears, you know exactly how they formed inside the Sicilian womb.
Yeah, and the other thing that was cool about that was how you were able to really provide context for why Sicily and Sicilian culture is really distinct in Italy. One question I was going to ask you is Sicily the Texas of Italy?
Yeah, the Lone Star State. Yes.
Like, yeah. Don't mess with Sicily.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't mess with us. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And the Alamo was the Italian unification. You know, that was sort of like, you know, when the resistance movement and, you know, well, the Alamo is quite different, but you understand it's a famous event in Texas history. And the unification of Italy was a famous event in mafia history in Sicily. They did not want to be. So how we then jump to America is at the same time, Italy becomes unified. You know, you have these movements, you know, the 1860s, 1870s, Italy is now one nation. You know, the Germans went through this during the time of Bismarck when they unified Germany. So Italy then goes through it. And now you have the people in Sicily were very unhappy. And at the same time, America abolishes the institution of slavery. The United States does. And they're in desperate need now of cheap labor. Very cheap labor to replace slave labor. And the doors were swung open here in the United States for immigrant labor. We need immigrants quick to fill up, to work these worst jobs, work the cane fields, work the cotton fields, work the tobacco fields, etc. And this huge Southern Italian immigrant wave, which included, you know, Southern Italian too, went through a lot of hell when after the unification. Southern Italy is very distinct from Northern Italy. I make that argument in the book and show you. This is well known to Italians, obviously, but people outside of Italy aren't familiar with it as Italians are. But Sicily also was part of that Southern Italian immigrant wave. And they migrated across the country in search of work. And with these huge waves of migrants came the mafia. A lot of fugitives left Sicily and said, well, the new world is opening up, I'll go there. And then with the Italian workforce taking over places like the waterfront along the eastern seaboard, taking over unions and stuff by sheer hard work ethics, not having to do with any criminal, the hardworking Italians. For example, the hardworking Italians, let's say, took over the waterfront because there's so many of them were hired in New Orleans that the mafia found it easy then to just organize them. We speak the same language. They're from the same place we are. And they organize them, and then it becomes sort of like a criminal element to it then. You know, once you have an organized union, then you have political power, you have political clout, you could control the docks. If there's citrus fruits coming in at the docks, it's perishable. Within a couple of hours, they rot. So if you stop the conveyance of citrus fruits to the French market and then throughout the United States, French market being in New Orleans, and then the rest of the United States, if we shut down the docks, we control the market. We could destroy this market overnight. So they have eventually now they start to gain power using the Italian work ethic, these mobsters did, to sort of like gain a foothold in different places. And I eventually did point that out as well. The Italians became very close with the Jews. And when the Jews were in, for example, New York, a lot of Jewish people who fled pogroms in Eastern Europe, they worked as seamstresses. They worked as, my grandmother worked in a sweatshop, and she worked alongside all Italians and Jewish ladies. And so they worked the hardest jobs in the garment industry. And then through their hard work, the Italian and Jewish hard work, the Italian and Jewish gangsters were able to organize these workers into a workforce and then eventually slowly infiltrate those unions. So, you know, the mafia capitalized on its own people being hardworking, ambitious people who just wanted a better life for themselves. And the mafia time and again was able to sort of ride in on that wave, attach themselves like parasites, you know, in many cases to these, you know, big, large groups of people who just wanted to work hard. And they would sort of dominate an industry through that hard work ethic. And then the mob would dominate that same industry by mobilizing the people into something that they could control.
Yeah, that was really an interesting dimension to this as well. I go to New Orleans a lot, and I'm always struck by the influence of Italian culture there. And I've never quite understood it. And it was really interesting to read you know, sort of those origins of the amount of immigration of Italians to Louisiana for the reasons that you shared. And that, you know, I think conventional wisdom, when people think about sort of the origins of the American mafia, they think New York. But you really point out that a lot of that formation actually was taking place in New Orleans because of that sort of combination of the labor work that was available there, the climate that was very appealing to Italians and to Sicilians in particular, and just the fact that New Orleans was pretty lawless back then.
Exactly, and those were all the main elements that went into the mafia becoming so strong in New Orleans, which surprised me when I began my research. I always assume New York, New York is sort of like the Rome of the Roman Empire. Everything that is, everything else is secondary. You have Alexandria, you have, Egypt and Tunisia, et cetera. Those were all outposts, Spain. Those were outposts of the Roman Empire, where Rome is where it all happened. So I always assumed New York was the center of power and everything else, because I was from New York and there were five major families there. But the more I did my research, the more I realized it all began in Louisiana, in New Orleans specifically, even before it sprung up in New York. And the reason being, like you said, the Mediterranean climate was closer to the New Orleans climate. You got people leaving the Mediterranean for the first time in generations, in thousands of years. The last thing they want is to deal with 9 feet of snow in New York, you know, in a bad winter. You know, these people aren't built for that. You know, it's like right now, just, you know, picking up somebody's born and raised in Florida their whole lives and telling them you have to go live in an igloo tomorrow in Alaska. You know, it's not the climate they're looking for. So a lot of Southern Italians migrated to Louisiana, where not only the climate was what they understood and liked and, you know, what we're used to, but also law. It was that's why the mafia went there, because it was lawless, but also because there was a lot of work there. And also, too, that, you know, they were depleted of slave labor. And they had to fill in for these, you know, what are we going to do without African Americans now? You know, where are we going with this? We need people quick. So they responded to that. And then the mafia found it the most lawless place in the United States. And by far it was. I found books after books written about how lawless Louisiana, specifically New Orleans, was at that time. It had always been known as that, whether it be smugglers and pirates, even before organized crime. I mean, this was... You read books where people lay dead in the street for days before the cops even took notice. You know, I mean, this is like complete lawlessness, and all the cops are on the take and the politicians are on the take. And then the Sicilian mafiosos land there and they're like, you got to be kidding me. I feel like I went around the circle and got off the boat in Sicily again. This is great. You know, it's like home. We could take over everything here. And they did. And they basically mobilized the criminal element there and they took over. And so they play a huge role in the very beginning of volume one of the Borgata trilogy, which just came out. But they come back. We see the resurgence of the New Orleans mafia at the beginning of volume two. So people who are interested in the New Orleans experience with the mafia, with regard to the mafia, we'll find it in the early chapters of volume one. And once again, we come back to it in volume two.
Awesome. Well, I'm coming back for that. Great. So, and we'll talk about that, but, so some of the things you spoke to also really address, you know, again, I think the conventional kind of wisdom of how we think about the mob, or the way I think about it, just because of watching the movies that you referenced, is that, you know, sort of the rise of the American mafia is really fueled by prohibition. You know, they then, you know, after after alcohol is legalized again, they then kind of go into sort of gambling and casinos and the rise of Las Vegas. And then later they get into drugs. And, you know, that's kind of very much the sort of the kind of narrative arc of Goodfellas, as you mentioned it. But what you're pointing out is that, you know, pre-prohibition, there was this really whole movement of how the mafia was really involved with kind of a lot of the inner workings of sort of the Industrial Revolution and supply chain and markets and human labor and, you know, and kind of working through a lot of that. What are some other kind of elements of sort of the mob that are kind of misunderstood in terms of kind of the roles that they were playing? Like, for instance, you know, during the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. The Great Depression was a great event for them, for the mob. And they're coming off, you know, off the heels of Prohibition. And Prohibition was the first time, as you mentioned, it's the first time, you know, these guys are, they're violent, they're criminals, and they're seen as that. So anytime mafiosos appear in the newspaper, you know, they're very discriminatory to references to them. These evil-looking Sicilians, these swarthy Italians, these are the references you find time and again in these newspaper clippings from early on. And the mafia wasn't thought of as anything sexy or romantic at that time. And then Prohibition comes around, and the mob, you know, and actually I make a strong argument that it all began with Arnold Rothstein, who was he was sort of a mentor, a Jewish guy. Came from a very different background than the sort of like Lower East Side Jews who gravitated toward the mafia, who had nothing, you know, to lose by going that route. Rothstein came from a good family, but he taught the mob. And there's direct testimony from mobster after mobster, Italian mobsters, saying, "I attribute this to Rothstein. I attribute that to Rothstein. He taught me this. He taught me that. He invested in me. He gave me this. He gave me that." One time and again. So this Rothstein becomes sort of like the Aristotle for this early school of mobsters, you know, the Lyceum of the early school of mobsters, Rothstein is. And at some point or another, these two other Jews approach Rothstein and they say, "Look, we got an entry point around the Great Lakes for liquor during Prohibition coming in from Canada. We need a $250,000 investment from you, and that'll give us the money to put together the fleet of boats, cargo vessels, and trucks. And with that, we can distribute it throughout the country with our own connections." And so Rothstein says, "Let me think about it." And he goes back and he comes back to them and he says, "Hey, look, I'll tell you what, I'm going to invest in this. We'll do it through the Great Lakes. But eventually the Canadians are going to squeeze us and squeeze us and squeeze us, knowing we only have them to rely on. So it's obvious supply and demand. They know if they're the supplier, the main supplier, the only supplier, we're in trouble. I'm going to try to open up another port of entry from Scotland." So he ends up making a connection with a distillery overseas in the United Kingdom. And he then brings in 12-year-old age scotch from the Scottish Highlands, Rothstein is. And then because his protege, Meyer Lansky, was best friends with Lucky Luciano, names most of your listeners have heard of, these two guys are young at the time, and Rothstein says, "I'm going to give you the sort of like managerial positions in this little operation we have over here," with big operation actually, with this alcohol. And Luciano then, because he's got aged whiskey that's top notch, top shelf, that every speakeasy in the country wants, he just supplants all of the Italians who are making, you know, rot gut, bathtub gin, and all of this other stuff from these makeshift distilleries that's pretty much just crap. You know, people are going blind, people are dropping dead, and here's Luciano coming out with stuff that, you know, we would crave today, you know, if we went to a restaurant. So Luciano then elevated himself inside the Italian mafia thanks to Rothstein. So Prohibition then gives the mafia, because Luciano then opens it up to the Italians. Rothstein eventually exits the business, but the Italians partner with the Jews across the country. And at some point or another, they come out of Prohibition and the Great Depression comes. The stock market crashed, the Great Depression, the banks are tightening up credit for everybody, the few remaining banks, most of them went under. And the few remaining banks are so tough to get a loan from that the mob now is flush with cash from bootlegging. And they start saying, "Okay, you need $100,000, I'll give it to you, but I want a piece of your company. You need $250,000, I'll give it to you, but I want some shares of your company. and they start to embed themselves in industries that they had never previously been involved in. And that was a big, big time, a big moment for the mob. You know, they literally just came off of pocketing all that cash during bootlegging, prohibition. And now everyone's short on cash. And who has it? The banks don't want to give it up. And the mob's the only ones who's got it and wants to give it up. So a lot of small business owners are going, it's better I partner with this guy called Joey Nine Fingers or Frankie the Foot, as opposed to going under and I can't feed my wife and children. So a lot of times they then embedded themselves in industries like the waste removal industry, the ice industry at the time. They used to have, you know, used to deliver ice and a million other industries that they eventually would take over, construction, et cetera. And they got, once they had a foothold in them, once they dug their talons into these industries, they never let go. They never let go.
And that is so critical to understand, I think, Lou, because that really kind of explains the origins of how the mafia has seemingly for decades been sort of integrated with these legal industries and entities. And there's this kind of shade of gray sort of area that it seems like they've been able to play in that space. How have they managed to be able to kind of sustain those kinds of arrangements for so long?
Well, a big part of it was they're savvy businessmen. And I wrote, before this book, I published a book called Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. And the book ended up becoming an international bestseller. It's been translated into 20 languages, and it's been tremendously successful. It's in its maybe 13th or 14th printing in Spain. It's a runaway bestseller in Vietnam. So every sort of place on earth, it's done extremely well. And what the book is it's if you strip away the violence, if you take away the violence, and the mob is violent. I make no excuses for their violence. I don't try to, in any way, do I ever make, am I apologetic or make excuses? They are violent. The mob is violent. But if you take away all the violence, there is still an extremely astute, savvy, business savvy that they exhibit every day. They know how to do business. I grew up in a neighborhood where the local supermarket, you know, once in a while you'd see this old man in a trench coat and a fedora. And, you know, he came in, he was in the manager's office for a little while. He counted a few dollars. He went over a few things and he left. And I was a kid. I didn't know till I was in the Gambino crime family that he was a capo in my family. And he still ran his supermarket chain very seriously. He just happened to be a capo in the mob, but he still had to put the right stuff on the shelves. He still had to produce, you know, source the best veggies, et cetera, and chicken, and you name it, he had to do it. So this guy's a smart businessman. That doesn't mean he won't kill you if he had to. But in my book, I stripped away the violence. So a part of it is they were very good businessmen. When they took over the garbage industry, they organized the garbage industry, which would have been chaotic without them. Now, I'm not making excuses. I'm not telling you it's better that they controlled the garbage industry. I don't want any of your listeners to get me wrong over here. But however, if you look back at the garbage industry, they put together a cartel where they said, these are your territories, everybody. You don't infringe on anyone else's territory. These are the prices. You don't undercut people and try to steal customers. And because of that, they allowed everybody, all the mom and pop garbage companies, to operate under their umbrella, but you had to listen to them. Now, at some point or another, when Rudolph Giuliani was a prosecutor and eventually the mayor of New York, he got rid of all the mobsters out of the garbage industry, one of them being a friend of mine who controlled all of the garbage on Long Island. So what happened then after that? I'm not going to say what he did was wrong. You need to clean up the mob. Okay, I get it. As a legitimate citizen today, I understand that. But let's look at what happened today now. Now you have one giant monolithic company that controls all the garbage in New York and Long Island, and all the small guys can't operate. They suck them up. So they're all put out of business. So if you had a wife with four kids and you used to operate a nice little 4 or 5 truck company under the mob, you just listened to their rules, you put up with their price guidelines, you didn't go outside your territory, but you took home 60, 80, 120,000 a year, whatever. Now the big company that took over, big company that trades on Wall Street, stock market, and everything else, they squashed you like a bug. and they told you you can't even survive here. Now you got to go look for something else to do. So there's an argument that could be made that there was a benefit to what the mob did. And I pointed out in my book at one point, George Friedrich Hegel said that selfish men also contribute to history's trajectory in a good way, even though in the midst of all their selfishness, a good example might be Rockefeller. Rockefeller put so many people out of business when he was controlling the oil industry in America, the original Rock, John D. Rockefeller. Excellent book, Titan, I recommend. By Chernow, I think it was, Ron Chernow. Yeah. Excellent book. He put everybody, squashed everybody. But in a sense, he helped the oil machine, you know, the machine of industry go to an extent that it would have never gotten to had he not done all of that. So in his all his selfishness, he contributed to the American project, to the American economy, to the American experience in so many other ways. Same thing with the mob. You know, they may control the waterfront. They may control different unions. They may control the garbage at those times, but they organized it when no one else was. And they contributed in so many other ways to you not waking up in the morning and going, when the hell are these people going to pick up my trash? The trash was picked up on time. They didn't want anybody calling the police going, when is trash coming, or the city. They wanted to make sure they did a damn good job so nobody complained. So, you know, there are goods and bads, and I point that out. I make no excuses for criminal conduct. I'm not excusing them. You know, I just want to make that ultra clear. But there was some benefits to what they did during those times, and that's why they were successful at it. And they also bought off a lot of politicians with the money they made. That helped them stay, stay entrenched, yeah. We have a very corrupt system in America, yeah.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about was a lot of the things that you cover in your other book, which I haven't read, which is, you know, what are some of the other kind of best practices that legitimate business leaders can learn from the mob?
I outlined 88 lessons in that book, Mob Rules. And there are so many lessons. I mean, you know, it's hard to just pick one. Time and again, there are so many different lessons. And the way I structured the book, this will help understand how the book, if for anybody who would like to read it. I structured the book in a way where I would use a mafia story that I was either familiar with or knew about, you know, either firsthand experience or knew about it. And then I would use also sometimes a historical vignette to further bolster the theory that I'm putting forth. And this is how you do business, for example. This is how the mob handled this particular situation. This is how also too, when this certain situation popped up either in business or in real world politics, this is how it was handled in the overworld. So then sometimes I'll supply a vignette as well. And this is how you should do it. And you know, once again, it's stripping away all the violence. You know, and the mob knows how to do that. You know, these guys are good businessmen. You know, so I urge people to anybody interested in just, it's just business lessons. Some people who are really good at business already might say, well, I know all this stuff already. That's fine. Maybe the book isn't for you. But a lot of people who like the entertaining stories and to learn a lesson through the story, that's basically who it's for. And there are a lot of good stories out there. A lot of people starting out in business who don't have someone to school them or help them have emailed me from all over the world saying, you know, I read this religiously once a year. I keep it on my bed shelf. I read this all the time. Before I go to bed, I read another chapter. I've been doing it for years. I read it 5 times. I read it 6 times. I have these people that email me from all over the world telling me it's become their Bible, you know, in a sense, their economic Bible, their financial, their business Bible, rather. So, you know, it's been successful because it's true. And when it was first, the idea for it came from a friend of mine. And he goes, you know, you tell me all these stories. You should put it together in a book. And I said, get out of here. Nobody's going to read that crap. And I, you know, and then he kind of like kept pushing me. And eventually I said, oh, let me put together something. I'll send it over to my agent. And she loved it. And, you know, she had me, Penguin picked it up, Penguin Portfolio picked it up in no time. And it turned out to be an international bestseller. One country after another scooped up the translation rights. And it surprised me, but it shouldn't. It shouldn't have, but it did.
Mm. You mentioned earlier, the code. What is the code? What's the ethos of the mafia? And has that remained consistent or has it changed over time?
It has extremely degenerated So it has not remained consistent, and it's changed over time as well. So the original code would be based on something called omerta. And omerta, in the original sense of the word, as taken from Sicily in the late 19th century, would second half of the 19th century, would mean being a man in every way. And what is it to be a man? Well, if you're a man, you raise your family, you grin it and bear. You don't complain to your wife. You don't complain to your friends. You do what you have to do. If somebody confronts you, you don't go to the police or the law. You take care of it yourself. These were the things that they did in Sicily. If somebody says, you know, whatever the case is, it's always about being a quote unquote man in every sense of the word. And the man I traced to the Italian sense of the word man was doing your duty. And that's interesting. Duty was very big. And what is your duty? You know, most American men, most men in the world, they go out, they break their backs every day for a day's pay. And even if they're white collar jobs, they break, you know, even if they're sitting on their asses, they work hard. Most people, and they carry the strain and stress of the week with them wherever they go, and they grin it and bear. And those men, believe it or not, in every industry in America, legitimate, are exhibiting what the Sicilians originally believed was omerta and doing your duty. You know, that's what you do. There was one instance where I point out in the book where a Sicilian pentito or rat snitch was ratting on a big mafia don in Sicily. And he says, you killed this guy, you killed that guy, you killed this guy, you killed that guy. And his only rebuttal was the Sicilian mafia don, who they used to allow, I'm not sure if Italian laws changed, but they used to allow you to confront your snitches. And he says, yeah, who are you to talk? You never even took care of your wife. So in this guy's mind, killing people was okay. That was being a man. He was doing his duty. If somebody got in his way, he killed them. But not taking care of your wife, that's something where, you know, that's breaking omerta. You're not being dutiful. You know, and obviously a jury with any sanity would say, this guy's a lunatic. You can't kill, you know, I'd rather you neglect your wife a little and don't kill 50 people. You know, I mean, that's like the American view of it, right? Okay, most wives are neglected anyway, in a sense. You know, well, this is the way it goes. You know, they deal with it too. But, you know, I mean, this was how they thought. So that omerta now has changed to just mean basically the way Americans think of it, American mafia, is the code of silence. You keep your mouth shut if you're questioned. Mm-hmm. You know, Louis, you know about this guy. Louis, you know about that guy. I don't know nothing. I didn't see nothing. I didn't hear nothing. That's omerta. That's how we think of it. But really, it was a bigger thing. It was a bigger deal. And it was like, you take your lumps. When I went to jail, I was faced with three different cases, two federal cases and a state case. I had all the pressure in the world on top of my shoulders. I had every reason to snitch and get out of it. And I remember my stepmother said to me, you know, the smart thing to do would be to talk, right? I said, yeah, it would be the smart thing to do, but it's not what I could do. It wasn't in me. So what was I doing? I was exhibiting, in a sense, what the Sicilians would have believed was omerta. I'm being a man in every way. I made my bed. I made my decisions. Nobody twisted my arm. Nobody forced me into it. I'm now suffering because of it, and I have to now man up and just suffer.
Mm-hmm. You know, shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about just the kind of process of writing the book itself. And one of the things that struck me was your really obvious point, which is that it's really hard to produce a comprehensive history of a topic and of a group that fundamentally intentionally don't write anything down.
Yeah, right.
or say anything in a way that is on the surface explicit. There's a whole code of communication that takes place in this culture, both in terms of the written record and making sure that there isn't one, and even you know, conversations and how those take place. So I'm curious, you know, how you were able to sort of overcome that obstacle.
I did it by using the bell in my head that goes off if something alerts me to this, something is off. So this bell rings in my head. And for example, so I'll give you a good example. When I was in prison and began to read and fell in love with books, I used to read 18 hours a day. And I knew that I needed to catch up with a world that I had fallen so far behind in. So I read physics, I read history, I read every branch of science. I read history, I read the law, I read philosophy, beginning with the ancient Greeks up until present day. I read the masters of 19th century fiction. I used to love fiction. That's how I taught myself how to write in many ways, by reading Flaubert, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. And time and again, I would hear guys reading on my TIA block. And most criminals gravitate, if they do read, most don't, but if they do read, they gravitate toward true crime. They want to read what they like, what they know. And I would hear a lot of people who read mob books back then, fellow mobsters of mine in jail, blurting out a lot of bullshit. No way. Never happened. Who wrote this crap? And you'd hear it all day long. And, you know, then later you talk to the guy, what'd you read? This SOB said this. This should have never happened, Louis. Come on. I go, yeah, I don't know where the guy got that one from. You know, but I didn't want to read the true crime book. So now here I am. I'm tasked with writing a history of the American Mafia. So I got to go through all of these books I didn't read, which it's a good thing that I didn't have to go through them twice. So it's better I didn't do it back then. But now, I'm going through them for the first time. And I'm seeing for myself what they were seeing. And I know right away if something doesn't ring true. There were no recorded records. There were no, you know, there were no, these conversations, there's no minutes. There's no stenographer taking minutes when the mob has a sit down. You know, these are things you got to, you know yourself. So I know if I read, for example, Albert Anastasia wanted to get the movements of Thomas Dewey, Albert Anastasia being a top mobster, Thomas Dewey being a prosecutor, was prosecuting the mob. They were thinking about killing him, so he was going to push a baby cart, and he ended up pushing the baby cart back and forth up a Manhattan street trying to figure out. Albert Anastasia was a boss. You really think he's going to push a baby cart? He'd have some kid do it. Like when I was 18, he'd tell me, Louie, go get a baby cart. Tell me what Dewey's doing. Okay, Al, talk to you in a little bit. You know, that's how those guys operate. So you know somebody's got this wrong. And then time and again, I would find this. They would say, Chin Gigante shot Frank Costello in the head, and he put on 50 pounds before he shot him because he didn't want anybody to notice him at the scene. I did a million crimes. You don't put on weight before you go to a heist. You don't think you're going to get caught. At the most, you put on a mask. Chin didn't even bother to put on a mask. He's not going to put on a mask, but he's going to lose 50 pounds or gain 50 pounds. Because some people said he lost the 50 after. Some people said he gained it before. I said, you go like you go. So then what's the reason, though, why he was 50 pounds lighter when he finally went to trial 6 months later or whatever it was? The reason was he botched the hit. He didn't know if they were going to kill him or not. You botched the hit, you die. So, you know, he was like probably shitting his pants and not eating, not knowing what he was going to knock at the door, was there to kill him or, you know, or just greet him and bring him more macaroni. So, you know, so the guy weans down to nothing. He finally goes to court. So, you know, it's, these things are obvious to me, you know, but if you don't know the mob and, you know, you got 25 years of college, but you never really held a gun. You never pulled a stiletto. You never had handcuffs on your wrists. You don't understand it. You know, your life was never on the line. You never had a sit down where you might not make it out of the room. You know, they might roll you up in a rug and that's the end of the day. You get thrown in a pickup truck. You know, if you never experienced that, you don't know what's right and what's wrong. So, you know, it's like me waking up tomorrow and going, yeah, I follow politics. You know, I think I'm going to write a history of the Oval Office. What the hell do I know about the Oval Office? I never even been in it. You know, I don't know what the president does and who he phones and who he calls and who he intercoms. And what the hell do I know how he deals with, other than what I read? But usually you want that history from someone who's been in the Oval Office, who's operated with one or two or three or four presidents, you know, who understands that world. So it's the same thing with me. But I'm the first guy who ever came from that world, that life, and understood it. And that was why Lord George Weidenfeld wanted me to write it. He says, nobody gets it like you. You got to be the guy who writes it. You know, nobody, yeah. Nick Pileggi, who wrote Casino, Goodfellas, Wise Guy, which became Goodfellas, the movie. Nick Pileggi is a friend of mine, great guy, amazing guy, always there when I need him, tremendous man, the epitome of omerta in so many other ways, you know, legitimate ways. But he said to me, I've never met anybody like you, somebody who came from that world and can walk away with the insights and experiences you have and the ability to write them down. You know, he says it's not something that I'm obviously free of false, you know, modesty, but when I make these statements to you, but I'm happy to report that was Nick Pileggi's take on me.
So to wrap it up, the book, volume one ends in the 1960s. You mentioned in volume two, we'll start in the early 1960s and we'll be back in New Orleans. What was kind of the thinking behind the sort of structure? And did you start out expecting and planning this to be a multi-volume work, or start to realize that brevity was perhaps not your strength, and you were going to have to extend it out? But what was the kind of sort of rationale, logic, and what can we expect to see in volume two and volume three?
It's a great question. And yes, brevity is not my strength, obviously, just from hearing me talk, right?
I share that.
Yeah, it's great. That's great. We find each other in this world too, right? That's funny. Exactly. So basically, it's a great question. Basically, when Lord George Weidenfeld contracted the book, he asked for supposed to be a one-volume history of the mafia. I began writing and I realized that this thing wasn't fitting into one volume. I just kept going. So I figured, you know what? When you're done, you're done. Keep going. And I would have hoped my other books took me a year to write. And I thought that this would take me a year. I didn't know that it took me, I basically was still getting through the Middle Ages and feudalism and stuff after a year. I was like, all right, this is going a long time. And, you know, at the time too, it's, you know, they don't dish out millions and millions of dollars for you. And in advance, I'm not Stephen King. So, you know, you have to live in the meantime too. You have to figure out how to survive and stuff. So I'm struggling to get through the initial stuff. And I realize this is going to be a long book. And at some point or another, after 7 years, it took me, I got 550,000 words and I hand it to the publisher, and you know, she goes, the woman in charge of the publishing company now, based out of London, Simon & Schuster bought the American rights. So Simon & Schuster / Pegasus is putting out the book here in America, but Orion is the publisher in England. And she said to me, I can't do this. And I said, why? War and Peace is 550,000 words. She goes, I couldn't sell War and Peace today. She goes, no one would buy it. So, you know, it's, you know, there's a few of us who want to read War and Peace. I'm one of them, but I was locked in a prison cell. You know, my hat's off to you if you read it in the real world. But so, you know, I said, okay. So she goes, cut it down and break it up. So I broke it up into a trilogy. I cut it down to roughly 330,000 words, about 110,000 each volume, which is what should be. And the reason why I go from 1860s Sicily to 1960 America, it was a nice cutoff. I found a perfect milestone. And by the grace of God, it just worked out this way. I didn't have to do any really forceful, you know, pushing squares into circular holes. You know, it was a nice break that I found. And I said, wow, this is perfect. 1960, it's about 100 years, but also too, there's a major change. Nobody is attacking the mob, with the exception of Esti Scafalva, Senator Esti Scafalva, who had the Scafalva Committee and went after the mob, but he never really followed through on it. With the exception of Thomas Dewey, who targeted a few mobsters so he could then run for governor of New York and then run for the Republican nomination for president, and then he lost to Truman. You know, that famous newspaper, you know, where Truman holds up the paper, it says Dewey wins. So with the exception of those people, there was never really a concentrated attack on the mafia as a whole. Volume two goes up until, so it starts around 1960 and goes up to 1985, which is where John Gotti took over the Gambino crime family. And that's sort of where the beginning of my own time. And then volume three picks up with my own contemporary times. And in volume three, it's very interesting because I not only was there, but I was also firsthand privy to some of the things that happened. I was also able to contact people who were involved in the thick of things, who would talk to me only because I never ratted. You know, a lot of people talked to me off the record and said, Louis, you know never to put my name in print, right? Of course. Okay, I'll tell you what happened. You know, that's so you. I got a lot of that. The inside scoops in volume three, straight from the horse's mouths. So that's sort of 1985 to 2005 is volume three. It's a 20-year period where the mob is in free fall. And that's sort of, you know, their last, it's autumn of empire. It's almost done. You know, and then that, you know, the epilogue will then wrap it up. But yeah.
Yeah. What was the biggest surprise for you during the course of developing the book?
There were quite a few surprises. I was surprised to learn how many people, how many nations invaded Sicily. I'm part Sicilian. My father's family is from Bari, which is in southern Italy on the Adriatic coast. My mother's father was from Naples and her mother was from Sicily. So so I am Sicilian. You know, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother is Sicilian. And I realized that there was a strong Arab influence in Western Sicily. And they had a lot to do with the origins of the mafia, which readers will find interesting, I believe. A lot of people have told me that already. And this was fascinating for me to learn how much Arab influence there was in Sicily. There are still churches that look like mosques in Sicily. Yeah, the Arab influence is very apparent there. But also, too, as far as, you know, I traced the mafia's founding fathers to the Arab Berbers of Western Sicily. So that was interesting to me. And then there were, along the way, there were a lot of things I found fascinating myself. You know, when you're in the mob, John Gotti, for example, I had mentioned John Gotti. John Gotti was one of the biggest mob bosses in the 20th century next to Al Capone, as far as notoriety, fame, et cetera, the most known face in the mob. Well, John Gotti doesn't know mafia history. He doesn't know what Charles Lucky Luciano said to Maya Lansky. He knows how to make a buck on the street right now. He knows Cosa Nostra as we know it today. You know, we didn't have history lessons. We don't go, okay, show up at the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club Monday morning. We're having a one-hour tutorial on the history of our origins. You didn't know. Nobody told you these things. What the hell you know? You know, I didn't know these things even when I was in jail. So, you know what you know around you. You hear old stories. You know, there's like this Homeric epic to the whole thing where there's this oral tales that you hear about, you know, so-and-so had a beef with so-and-so, and this is how it was straightened out. This is how it went. You know, that's how mafia case law sort of comes about. So new sit-downs can be decided based on the decisions of old sit-downs and stuff like that. So, you know, sort of like the immediate past, but you don't know the deep history. So that was something I found fascinating myself as I studied it.
Very cool. Well, Lou, congratulations. Really enjoyed the conversation, and we'll look forward to seeing Volume 2 when it comes out.
Same here. Thank you, Jason, and I appreciate you reading the book, and I'm so glad you enjoyed it, and I hope to come back for Volume 2.
Sounds great. Thanks again.
Cool. Thanks, buddy.
So there you go. Wind him up and watch him go. Lou Ferrante. If you're interested in learning more, go to louisferrante.com. The link is in the show notes. Volume 1 of the Borgata Trilogy, Rise of Empire, is out now. Thanks to Lou Ferrante. A fun conversation. Thanks for listening to the History Factory podcast. I'm Jason Dressel. Be well.